Okay, and we are good to go. We're recording. Hi, Jess, how are you?
I'm doing excellent, Brendan. How are you?
I'm not so bad. It's been a wild week out there in the world, as always.
It has been. I know yesterday was some pretty big news
Yeah, how do you feel about that?
about Kamala Harris being
Yes.
selected as Joe Biden's running mate.
Kamala.
Kamala, thank you. Kamala. I mean, I was hoping he would have somebody more progressive. I've never really cared much for Biden, but this doesn't change the fact that I'm still going to vote for him.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's what we've been hearing so much of now. There's like just an interesting mix across the board of people standing her hard, and then also people being like, oh my God, like of all the people he could have picked in this moment, you know, he chose a cop. He chose, you know, he didn't even pivot to the left at all. There was no kind of a extended olive branch. And yet, all the people who say that in their most, you know, vehement takedowns of her are just like, well, I mean, it doesn't really matter. And in which case, it's like, well, then, yeah, obviously, if it doesn't matter, then he made the right choice because, oh well. So I have been, yeah, dealing with that. One thing that I found particularly interesting, and I don't know if you've noticed this, especially over the past few days. And on the heels of the announcement yesterday, where people are like, oh my God, like Kamala's gonna debate Mike Pence, right? Like, this is gonna be just such an epic takedown. Like, there's very much a sense where it's like, well, all right, we're gonna take our country back. That's something I've heard from so many ostensible liberals, you know, and it's like, one, a line directly out of kind of this ethno-nationalist playbook that Trump has used. But also it's like so reactionary and I can't get over it. It irks me to no end. It's like, why are we looking backwards? To me, the definition of insanity would be to go back to a pre-Trump era in which you have erased Trump's existence because it ignores the corrosive elements in that pre-Trump era, which are directly responsible for his rise and eventual election. And there's just like an absolute like cognitive dissonance I feel of anyone who wants to kind of just, you know, roll back to the Obama years and erase this, you know, blasphemous presidency from the stain on the American consciousness. And it's like, no, this is the culmination of that year of that period that you're venerating. And you have to look forward. There's like no choice. I don't know how you feel about that, but that's been something that's really irking me lately.
That is such an interesting point, Brendan. And it is curious that the rhetoric, it's almost like Trump's rhetoric, right? Like, oh, we're going to make America great again. We're going to make it great again. Just the idea of we're going back to the way things were. We're like, wait a second. A lot of us weren't content with things the way they were. Interesting for sure. But then, I mean, to think about everything that's happened. I mean, can't you see it? Can't you imagine it being useful to have certain institutions protected? When I say certain institutions, I mean like voting, right? Like very basic things that have been disrupted by Trump's presidency.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, and this is me kind of capitulating in the same way that all of these people I'm complaining about have capitulated. Like, I will vote for Biden. But I am skeptical, right? So there's a sense, especially among kind of like the accelerationist kind of camp, where it's like, okay, obviously Trump makes things worse. And therefore, in order to expose like the true like systemic issues at the root here, like having him in office is actually more beneficial in the long run. 'Cause when we finally beat him, we can beat him in like the right way. Like there will be, I mean, you can call it a revolution, whatever you want to say. Whereas, you know, that's the accelerationist standpoint. But to me, there's also a hint of accelerationism in this capitulation to Biden, because in this kind of like looking backwards, right? Like we're gonna take whatever wins we can get. it seems like you are just setting the playing field for an even worse Trump in the future. And like, there's an accelerationism in that sense where it's like the status quo, which gave us Trump, is what's to be protected because Trump is worse than the status quo. But if we keep hammering in the status quo and we keep reverting to the status quo over time, do we not learn our lesson when the next step, which is reverting back to a Trump-like figure, just gets more and more severe with each passing day? And this is, I mean, I just have this inherent skepticism towards anyone who's like, you know, well, Biden this, Biden that. Again, I think I'm not in the position to say that like the material gains that Biden's presidency would give to those most impacted by the Trump presidency, like those are worth my vote. But I also do think we need to really watch what rhetoric we use and really like have a fully fleshed out idea of what kind of historical processes we're taking part in. I don't know. But clearly people feel many different ways about this. I don't know how that matches up with you.
Well, the accelerationism is always something that I just think is so fascinating to talk about. And especially thinking about, as you were saying, acceleration, it'd be accelerationist not only if Trump was elected, but also with Biden being elected, right? Maintaining that kind of status quo that led to Trump. That's curious. And to me, that makes me think that in ways we're pushing off the change that we actually need to see happen, right? We're kind of just like, oh, well, let's just fix this big problem right now and we can go ahead and carry on. And that's where it almost starts to sound a bit conspiratory as well, right? Like, you know, this talk, oh, well, Trump's just a distraction from the real problems. Mm-hmm. And then it gives us something to rally behind and we're like, we got rid of him, guys. And then like, oh, we've saved everything, but actually everything's like the way it was beforehand. You see what I'm saying with that?
No, absolutely. Yeah, I was thinking very much on that note about how like during the investigations into Trump's campaign, like, you know, what we would call Russiagate, I often got that sense that like in the investigation of Russia and like the kind of delegitimization of his like electoral victory, where people would be like, oh no, this could not have happened in the United States. This has to be like a Russian plot because like we are unwilling to confront the dark side. And especially as this investigation went on and it like, obviously there was so much, you know, unethical behavior in the Trump campaign, but no more than I think is conventional in electoral politics. You got to the point where the idea of this campaign to kind of condemn Trump as a Russian agent was to, one, kind of patch up our own misgivings about like the domestic situation at home and kind of put a Band-Aid on it and be like, we don't actually need to address what happened here because this is a Russian plot. But when it failed, there was this deep sense of, again, a kind of a conspiratorial element to it, right? And I actually think that a lot of the kind of like Republican distaste towards that investigation was, while maybe misplaced, on a sentimental level, valid. I think about Watergate and what happened in the 70s, where it's like during the 60s in this huge period of just like antagonism towards the US government and just like faith in US government at all-time lows. The idea was, well, like, oh, if the system rallies kind of behind itself and looks like it's cleansing its bad apples, like by booting Nixon out of office, then faith in the system will be restored because like the system can correct itself. And of course, at the time, the 70s were, even after Nixon was cleansed, like that did not get to the systemic rot at the heart of American politics, which blew up in unprecedented ways during the remainder of the 70s and beyond, in ways we're still dealing with. And now it seems like we're at this really unprecedented time where the system tried to do that again. They tried to cleanse their so-called bad apples in the Trump campaign, but all they got was like faith in government is almost too low. We are at a point that's even worse than the 60s, where even this, like, the system can't even rally the support necessary to sustain itself. And mm-hmm. Now you have just like this deep schism. So yeah, I totally hear what you're saying about like in this status quo trying to maintain itself, there's this conspiratorial element. And like, again, is that the real accelerationist platform that just like ignore that? I don't know.
I'm curious into what sort of ways you see the system as having imploded in the 70s into the 80s. Because when I think, you know, the 80s, like my mind's automatically going to Ronald Reagan and the sort of policies he was making that really were a golden day for a lot of wealthier people, you know, and growing up where I grew up in the South, a lot of people were like just big fans of him. Like you still will see Reagan Bush 84 shirts.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's like, what are you doing? You're 23. But, right? So I think, you know, there's a big section, there's a very visible section of America, right? Because the people who are benefited by his politics are visible people. They're big names. They're the kind of folks who we learn about and like the history makers and the influencers who are,
right.
You know, they're made legends in TVs and movies. They were the big names of their time, but obviously, there were also a lot of people really suffering in the 1980s, especially think about things like the crack epidemic. And so when you say, when you're talking about the 1970s and the explosion of government, what are you thinking?
Well, one thing to kind of loop back to what we were just saying, and I think this is a good example of the kind of precarity of a golden age. To me, it seems like a golden age that eventually disintegrates, or if like a golden age that descends into chaos because of the golden age was never a golden age to begin with, right? Like if the rot was there, if the bedrock had been laid to kind of like foster this discontent, then like you can't call that a golden age. Or like, again, the people who were calling it a golden age are obviously the villains of that scenario. So yeah, the 70s, I think, and in the context of kind of the current moment, really started this, not started, but there was a kind of consolidation of capital and the state, where it was like, in order to kind of quell the discontent of the 60s, like there needs to be kind of a massive social overhaul in how our systems work. And we need to kind of obfuscate where power lies, and kind of throw the dog a bone, to a sense. Like that was one of the prevailing sentiments coming out of the 60s. What was like, we'll give you material gains, but like, don't ask for social justice. Cause like that was one of the big things in the 60s. Like when everyone was kind of down and out on their luck, they were calling for not only like, you know, kind of a share, a slice of the pie, but also for justice, for that pie to be distributed forthcoming, or, you know, going forward in a just and equitable way. And in the 70s, obviously, a lot of that justice centered around kind of reformation, or even kind of a dissolution of capitalism as we know it, and kind of reparative justice, righting past wrongs, et cetera, like entering people into the conversation who are obviously the victims of the American story up until that point. And that presented a serious enough threat to, I think, the kind of just order of American politics and the order of the American elite at that time, that they were like, all right, well, the way we're going to be able to kind of deal with this is, one, if in Watergate we appear to cleanse ourselves so that people will have faith in us, kind of your average like working class white American especially, and then from there, through this kind of like unbridled finance capitalism, like we will expand in a very short term the productivity of, you know, the American workplace, etc. And what you get through the 80s is obviously short-term gains. Investment was great, people were making the return on investment was super high, but it was at that point that the distancing between the compensation for the American worker and like the average productivity, that gap skyrocketed. And like, that's what we're seeing now. And there was also, again, the rise of kind of the religious right and the kind of coalition and alliance between the religious right and big capital, which is something we're still dealing with in really perverse ways. But in a lot of ways, the groundwork for our current moment was laid during the 70s. And I think the example of Russiagate and Watergate as being two kind of like synonymous sort of scandals, is really best understood through that lens. But then of course the necessary conclusion there is that in the kind of dissolution of Russiagate as an actual scandal, the fact that nothing ever really came of it speaks to a profound transformation. We are no longer in the late 70s. We are no longer stuck in that cycle. We are in somewhere new. And that's what's interesting, among other things. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well to think of the Republican Party going against Nixon, right? He gets impeached. And obviously people tried to impeach Trump, but that was mainly Democrats, and there were a few Republicans. But for the most part, the Republican Party has stayed backing Trump. However, there are still like some big names within the Republican Party, you know, like Mitt Romney and the late John McCain, who have been pretty clear from the beginning that they're not interested in Donald Trump. And I think that's really interesting because these are established, well-respected names. And I'm curious who are these Republicans? I was listening to a piece today and the woman was identifying herself as a traditional Republican. And that's interesting, right? Because traditional Republican, that's like a true Republican is sort of how I interpret that in my head. Like, hey, these other Republicans, you know, they've changed. Maybe they've let go of the ways or whatever. And I wonder to what extent, I wonder where she would draw the line between a traditional Republican versus the new Republican. I'm curious if that would involve anything that you're talking about with the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I think the new Republican is, and this is obviously very complicated, and you might actually be able to speak better to it than I can. But the new Republican seems the discontent of the 60s has reared its head again in the Republican Party. It's not even the discontent of the 60s. I mean, it's a discontent that has been a staple throughout all kind of class conflict in American history. It's reared its head again after a period of relative quiet. A period where kind of the throwing the dog a bone, deal with, you know, economic, you know, progress at the expense of social justice, that'll tide you over for now while we are able to kind of really consolidate kind of the kind of vision of global capital that we have in mind. Now you had this chance where in this agitation towards the global elite, in this agitation towards, an America that no longer really works for them, like white working class America, which has long been a Republican base, turn to revolt and eat alive your kind of classic rhino, or what they would call a Republican in name only, which is really someone who was on board with the Republican platform, or even kind of the bipartisan consensus that like characterized the 90s and early 2000s. But the Republican Party is what moved on. The people have what moved on. And I feel like in the current situation, understanding the tides that got Trump elected, there's very much there's a populist undertone. I don't know. I caught some flack for this opinion just after the election, but you know, everyone was crying about how Trump proved that our democracy was broken. In some ways, I feel like Trump actually proved that our democracy was working. I mean, in the way it was meant to work. I mean, Trump overcame incredible odds. Trump truly hijacked the Republican Party. And the way in which he did so, we should learn from, because it's actually, I don't want to say it's a good hijacking, but the Democrats have not learned their lesson from it, clearly. Many Republicans still don't know exactly what to do with it, but it doesn't make it any less legitimate. I mean, obviously you can say that, okay, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. How can you say that Donald Trump's election was a victory for democracy? And it's like, well, I mean, this is the same issue that's inherent in like just the founding fathers' vision of what democracy in America would be, right? You had the kind of the little guy able to, the little guy being like kind of like your again, white working class heartland of America, able to refute the population centers of the coast and get their representative into the highest office. And it's like, that is at the core of what it means to be in this American political system. And like, if you want, this is another thing that irks me. So many people who are like, all right, like, you know, Donald Trump is a you know, threat to democracy, and I, or the Democrats, we are the true defenders of the Constitution. It's like, shut up. Like, you do not care about the Constitution at all, nor should you. The Constitution is antiquated by your own definitions. Like, don't, who cares about who is trampling on the Constitution? You would yourself admit that the very structure upon which this country was founded, like, doesn't really work, or is antithetical to your own personal beliefs, even if they're subconscious, about how democracy should work. I don't know. It's ridiculous.
So that's interesting. With the Constitution, we do have this old document that's talking about Black people being 3/5 of a person and all kinds of other wacky stuff written by some dudes. And what is it, a stuffy room in Pennsylvania? Yeah. We know the myth. That's so interesting to me as well. All those stories we have, you know, George Washington and the cherry tree and his wooden teeth. And
no, it's the mythology.
Truly. The founding fathers. So the Constitution, this old document, but is the Constitution a living document, right? Is it a living zeitgeist of ideas and principles as well? That's always, always changing.
I mean, I guess I have to ask, like, turn the question to you, like, as a Black person living in America, like, what does the Constitution mean to you?
That's a good question.
I would say it means little to me, but am I speaking from an immense point of privilege, able to kind of discount the milestone that it, you know, it undeniably was, in kind of the progress of what we would now call human rights, even if it was fundamentally flawed? I don't know. Flipping it to you.
So within the American story and within the American documents that define our story, whether it's the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, even like Thomas Paine's Common Sense, all those pamphlets, they really use some amazing language. And I respect the language that they sometimes use.
Right.
There's a lot of language that I don't respect. That's very, oh gosh, that's very hateful, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they do a really good job of stirring the heart and talking about these grand ideas that just sound, you know, really amazing. Like, hey, everybody has, well, every man, you know, has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that sounds like a really beautiful thing that, like, I could get behind if we could make man apply to all humans. Yeah. You know, so it's like little things like that, that you, I feel like we could work with. And so, but then you think, okay, well, who is the man? Can we actually change it, right? If the roots are rotten, isn't the fruit going to be rotten too? But the language itself is, I think, can so easily be reclaimed. You know, I feel this way about the Gadsden flag too.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yes, exactly, that flag with the snake, for those who don't know, that says, don't tread on me. And it's really like a big conservative libertarian thing. But I mean, when you have the police literally kneeling on the necks of people, arresting them, you know, the state invading our lives and threatening our, our lives. And to me, that makes a lot of sense to wear the shirt that says, don't tread on me. And then it also kind of is a bit of a historical FU as well. But I was thinking, with what's happening, I've been seeing a shift in representation of protesters by their sympathizers and the protesters themselves as the true Americans, which is very interesting, because not very long ago, we were like, screw America, you know? And now people are like, oh, this is the true American. This is the real American fighting spirit, fighting for what's right. The Constitution is a living document that's always changing. It's not stuck to this little piece of paper in the Smithsonian or wherever the heck it's housed. And I think that there is something so powerful that people want to grab, that people want to use. Hey, America's always changing. It's in the hands of the people. Who cares who had it yesterday? It's ours now. And that fighting that, oh no, we can't even deal with this. You know, this is too messed up. Which is more powerful? I don't know, but I do think that I think there's a lot of power when you can use the same language. I think that can be pretty powerful.
Yeah, I mean, reclaiming the narrative to a point.
Yeah.
Can you speak more on, you think, the reclamation of the Gadsden flag? I think that's a really interesting thing. There was some controversy, not controversy really, but some people at my school recently who in one of the kind of the anonymous social media pages that was going on to talk about, you know, the experience of being Black at Bowdoin, right? The Gadsden flag hanging on the wall of like someone's room, just being like a insufferable red flag. And like, really, you know, and then I know that, you know, you have your Gadsden flag t-shirt and you wear it all the time. And it's like, I don't know, what's the kind of the thinking behind that?
So first of all, my experience with the Gadsden flag was I saw it in school when we were learning about the Revolutionary War. This is like a while ago, right? Mm-hmm. So I had really only known it in that context. I had never really associated it with libertarianism or mm-hmm. republicanism. And only recently, with what's going on right now, I was like, hey, you know, it seems like it fits this moment, that flag. So I looked at the flag, like, and I was like, yeah, don't tread on me. And then as I looked it up, I started seeing all of its associations, and I was like, oh, that's messed up. But I just think it looks cool. It's a snake. Don't tread on me. Like, as I was already saying, I think the message is very relevant from where I'm standing. And I also feel like, because I didn't know the way it was used, I'm sure there are other people who don't know. You know, I don't feel like they fully have it in the way that, say, like, the Nazis have the swastika, right? I feel like it's still a little bit of a marginal symbol. So I think there's space to take it back. And it's also interesting as well, because Brendan, you know this, and maybe most of you listeners will know this, but some of you won't know this, but I'm like a Black woman rocking my Afro. So I think me wearing the Gadsden flag, just on the kind of stereotypes people tend to have, I don't think I would really line up with who they would imagine wearing the Gadsden flag. And I think that that juxtaposition is likely sufficient enough to have somebody, if they're thinking about it, they might not even, you know, care, you know, but if they are thinking about it, I think that they might be privy to the fact that there's something up there, right? It's maybe not exactly what it appears. So I think it's conversational.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. And I really want other people to wear it too, but you know, we'll see. I think that'd be cool. I saw one image of, what was it? It was like a Black Panther choking the snake. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
It was on a big flag. Somebody had at a protest. I don't know where it was. Yeah, it wasn't in Georgia, somewhere else.
Was the text still the same, or had the text on the flag changed as well?
I think it said something like, "We will tread."
That's actually, I actually find that very interesting. Oh wow, this kind of maybe a segue, but
loaded I've been up.
Thinking. No, I mean, this is this just gets at so many different things. I was thinking lately, I've been reading lately, kind of, and we've talked lately about kind of liberalism and conventional liberalism, contemporary liberalism, and how "don't tread on me" as like kind of this American motto is so strangely implicated in like the liberal system in which we've concocted, where the idea that like imposition, right, like everyone has a right to do their own thing, right? I mean, this so imposition, you kind of taking your beliefs and imposing it on others, that is like the greatest form of tyranny. I mean, this is, you know, something that is runs as an undercurrent to kind of like all American political thought in a million different interesting ways, but very much in that notion, right? Like, don't tread on me. Like, you do you, I do me. Obviously, the history of the Gadsden flag is very specific to kind of a political tyranny in the Revolutionary era, but the kind of sentiment stays strong. And implicated in that now, I think we are seeing the ways in which the fruition of that thinking is kind of falling apart, because in this like liberal order where it's like everyone is tolerated, everyone kind of just do their own thing, the greatest threat to that order is someone like imposing their beliefs on others, which is like obviously an inherent anti-radicalism. But what it really does is it opens up this kind of glaring hypocrisy, because in order for no one to impose their belief on anyone else, there has to be this like neutral, agreed upon mediator, right? Like the center upon which all radicalism is kind of held up to. But in the creation of that paradigm, you obviously, not only does someone have to define where that center is, where the center of kind of this liberal consensus is, but there is now the greatest tyranny of all, which is the fact that because no one can impose themselves on that apparently like neutral, unthinking center, and radicalism is inherently like stigmatized, no one can even approach like all-encompassing change. Like change itself obviously has been marginalized to the point where anyone who thinks differently from the norm is a liability. And you can celebrate tolerance and diversity under this liberal system, but ultimately like it is a stranglehold upon who actually like is able to conduct the kind of mechanisms of society. I don't know. Does that
break that down for me a little more?
Okay. What parts?
So I'm getting strong, like, if you're outside, if you don't touch on that center, you don't really have a space, right? Like, you have to be on this basic level of understanding that X, Y, and Z is okay within this sphere. And if you're so radical that you're like, you know, all of that's inherently wrong, right? You're out. You're no longer polite. You're no longer able to have that conversation. It's like the shared base of knowledge is gone.
All right.
And so, for example, I'm thinking violence. Right? Like, that's impolite. Like, that's beyond...
That's one way to put it, yeah.
That is beyond impolite. Where if you're talking violence, I mean, in most circles, the vast majority of circles, that automatically exclude you from the circle.
Mm-hmm.
You're not even on the same playing field.
Yeah, right.
I would say even being anti-capitalist to an extent is sort of outside of that playing field as well, like the moderate field that we see when we turn on a news station or anything of the mm-hmm. like anything that's kind of like generally consumable has become very even, very flat.
Yeah,
I'm not out here saying it's time to have, you know, no, not at all, but I do. That's just what I'm taking away from.
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting, because I guess to clarify kind of what I mean is rather that like we talked the other day in that excellent phone call we had about the kind of like false dichotomy between the two like poles that we're fighting for right now, being like fascism, some sort of totalitarian fascism, and like some kind of multicultural liberal democracy. Like, it is in that false dichotomy that you can kind of see what the true like struggle is. And I think one of the reasons that is because in a way, when you have this kind of this like center, this liberal center that's like, all right, like this is enshrined in law, whatever it is, this is what is polite, this is what is acceptable, the greatest infraction you can do is to take your beliefs about how the world should work and impose it on other people. Because supposedly we have already come to an agreement on how the world should work.
Yeah.
So there's a tyranny there. But of course the paradox is that in that stigmatization of like dissent and how the fact that now the state's ability to crush that dissent is marketed as on the behalf of the people themselves, there is no real, like there's no real avenue for dissent. And that seems to be one of the most totalitarian sources of power of all.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the question is, there's no way out of here, but the way in which, or is there a way out of here, I should say. But of course, going back to what we were just saying, the way in which that intersects with this American idea, this kind of, you know, that American, good old American fighting spirit, don't tread on me. Like, you do your thing, I do my thing. Yet we have wandered into like one of the most insurmountable structures of power that the world has ever known. I don't know. I don't really fuck with that. I don't know how you feel.
I just don't know where we go from here. I know where I'd like to see us go from here. I want us to have more community engagement. I want us to be more together. I want us to talk to each other more, to actually listen, to keep our ear to the ground and get going. And that's really the only way out that I can envision, because everything happens in that realm of speaking to other people, you know, like if you write a book, like nobody cares unless you publish it. That's what I'm trying to get at. Nobody cares unless you publish it. If you write a book and you just keep it in your closet or something.
Yeah. No, totally.
Terrible. You know, but it all happens through communication. Even like the ideas that you get to write that book come from communication. So I feel like that's really the number one thing to get out. And it's, but it needs to happen at a large scale.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know you've talked a bunch recently about ways in which you feel like you're doing that personally, or ways in which you're watching other people try to kind of get out. What do you think are some strategies?
Some strategies?
I don't know. Yeah. Some useful avenues.
Well, okay. So some of the people around me, many of the people around me are some of the most inspiring folks. And I'm like, it's amazing that you live in my community. And, you know, perhaps this is just the Atlanta spirit, but maybe it's just the human spirit in action. I think it is, because I know amazing people all over the world, like yourself. And I think some of the coolest work that I see is going on with agriculture. Mm. And it could be because I'm super partial to agriculture. I've been a fan for some time now. But I think there's a lot of power that comes from people getting together to sort of reclaim their health, express their care for the earth, and also kind of stick it to the man in a way. I think all of that is really cool. And just feeding people, feeding yourself, is like one of the most basic things you can do. And our capitalistic global supply chains have completely messed with this system that is so natural and inherent to eat food and to share food. So work around food is always so fascinating to me. And that's why I'm so excited for when we interview Umi of Umi Feeds, because I know she's just going to have so much to say.
Coming up.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about, maybe on that note, what you were just talking about, your personal relationship with reclaiming food systems? And I know this is stuff we'll talk about with Umi, but just to kind of maybe preface it a little bit. And on the notes that we've covered so far in this episode.
Oh, of course. I mean, see where to begin. I'll begin with the fact that I've always loved nature. I've always loved being outside, and I wanted to move towards like self-sufficiency, and that's what got me interested in food, because I mean, how else can you be sufficient? You know, growing your food is like the number one way to be self-sufficient. So I started working on farms, and it was just a really positive experience. And so over the years, I've built a couple of gardens, one at my university with the help of an amazing group of people on the student environmental team. And then I built another one in Costa Rica, and I built one here at my house, helped out friends and stuff with theirs. And it's just a really beautiful experience, you know, and like going to community gardens is really amazing too, because people come to those places and they exist outside of a dominant culture of popping into the Kroger, the Wayfield, the Publix. You know, they have their own space where ideas flourish and people exist and create their own almost like sovereign communities. Like I feel like when I'm on in my garden, like that is it's like its own sovereign state. You can't tell me what to do in my garden. It's my space, and it's like special, and land is special. Land is so important. And I mean, us Black folks promised 40 acres and a mule. It didn't happen. What is it called? The Treaty of Hidalgo? I believe there was this treaty that happened when a lot of what was Mexico became the United States, and all these Latino and Latinx people were promised, oh yeah, don't worry, you can keep your land. But then, you know, the U.S. pulled its stuff, and they did not keep their land. Spoiler. You know, and then you think about like the Native Americans and all their land snatched. Land is so important because cultures, entire cultures, arise from how people get along on their land. You know, what they do with where they're at, ancestors, foods, language, all of it being so influenced by the land you are on. And to be alienated from that land, to have that land become money, something to be bought and sold, is nasty. And I know in my own family, we actually did have land. in Mississippi, but there used to be just a lot of exploitative ways in which people took land, especially if you're somebody who doesn't read or write. Anybody could come up and be like, hey, your papers are not correct. Or, oh, you're actually supposed to pay this amount of money. And if you're not educated, what the heck are you going to say to that?
Yeah.
Nothing. So land is important. And I think as well, there's a trauma that surrounds land. And you can see it with a lot of groups. So I'll speak specifically to the Black experience. There's a collective memory and trauma surrounding land and surrounding agriculture, for that matter, because, I mean, your first understandings of Black people with land when you grow up is like, oh yeah, we were slaves. We were forced to farm. When I first wanted to farm, my parents were like, what are you talking about? And they're, you know, and my mom's super supportive of me now. But, you know, at the time she was like, that's what our family worked so hard to get away from. Mm. So I feel like to be able to reclaim a connection with agriculture is just really important. It's very, it's vital. It's vital to your health, your wallet, you know, to just determining who you are in this world, to not just purchase and consume what they tell us to, what they want us to, but to be able to develop your person and to have relationships that aren't commercial as well. Because I think the commercialization of relationships and the commercialization of community is pretty disturbing.
Yeah.
Think about so many places you can only go there if you're trying to buy something. The community garden's not like that.
Yeah, it's to pay to be anywhere. So I hear that 110%. No, I think that's, I mean, everything you said is phenomenal. And especially around this idea of the farm, or at least kind of the closed agricultural system as being practically or functionally autonomous territory. I think we've talked a lot about, I mean, revolution, take that as you will, whatever that means now. Right, one of the classic kind of conundrums of any revolution, and one of the reasons why we've kind of been dispirited by so many failed revolutions over the 20th century is because in taking the harnesses of state power, if your revolution is like kind of, you know, up the bottom up, like we're going to seize the state, we're going to seize control, but then you just have the same apparatuses that the oppressor had, it's so easy to repress or fall back, regress, I should say, into that role. But what you're getting at about kind of starting small spaces that are kind of autonomous and removed from the general kind of paradigm, when kind of you can fly under the radar and slowly these autonomous spaces link up and get bigger and bigger until the state has almost been supplanted to the degree where the infrastructure, you're not taking the oppressor's infrastructure, you have actually created your own infrastructure, and it has like a parasite within the belly of the beast and just like drained it to the point where now you have like you have control. I think that is such an important, like, radical but like and subversive and emancipatory vision. Yeah. Right,
it's exactly what I think needs to happen. Exactly what needs to happen. But notice it's community based, right? It's not just me on my own garden. Like you said, they start linking up. Start linking up, right? And like they trade, they barter. You know, you don't have to mess with their stuff, right? Like just make your own stuff. And I feel like that's where as well, like decentralized energy sources. Oh my gosh. You know, that's where it's at. That's the real good stuff. Be able to control, to have that kind of control over your own life. To know the people who are involved in these aspects and to trust them and not just have it be Georgia Power.
Right.
One of the biggest polluters in the state. Like, you can't call up Georgia Power. I mean, you can, but you'll be on hold for a few hours.
Yeah, we just had this, the Hurricane Isaias, or I guess Tropical Storm Isaias, blew through last week. Connecticut, just power was leveled. So, and we recently just privatized the energy grid to this company called Eversource. And personally, my family, we live in an area with relatively few trees, which is constantly something that bugs me, like a kind of a suburban strip. But in instances like this, when the wooded neighborhood has just had like trees down on every wire, kind of my blessings. But regardless, no, learning from, as you said, this kind of like, we've put so much into the hands of this like corporate entity, and like people are truly just immobilized when they don't have power to reclaim energy for themselves. I mean, not to romanticize the kind of the public energy grid had problems to begin with, because what you're getting at is something that's so much deeper than that. But I think, I mean, hopefully these things are wake-up calls, not only to the horrors of privatization as a whole, but also going beyond just nationalizing or creating these public utilities, having a deep like connection with those utilities, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
I feel like one of the biggest issues of our modern age is the standard, or our postmodern age. We'll be getting into that one
later.
Stay
tuned.
Stay tuned, everybody. This is a hint. But one of our biggest issues, I think, is our standardization of everything, to the extent where if we think that a child won't function in our society, we call them deviant, you know, because they're not standardized. They can't function within the standardized system. Like any kind of outlier is just like non-functional. Mm-hmm. And we devalue anything that doesn't plug into this equation just the way we need it to.
This is exactly what I'm saying about kind of the paradox of liberalism as it relates to that center, that like supposedly neutral center. Because any deviation is a liability, and it like leads to so much insidious racism and ableism and any difference. It's like the classic, you know, I mean, yeah, not to rewind to where we just were, but like, again, as you were saying, the standardization as things relate to the center, because the center there is no liability in the center. Right. If you are if you are like completely disembodied and you are just like the you know spirit of this like liberal utopia, right? Like you every law is perfectly represented with perfectly aligned with your belief. There's never any incentive for you to stray or to you to challenge anything or revert. Then you are someone who like the system can work with. You are, in fact, that is the perfect person for the system to work with, because the person will uphold that system at all costs. And when the system sees itself as the only buffer between, again, this supposed ultimate tyranny of imposition from someone who disagrees, then that person is implicitly the center of that society.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who deviates from that standard is, you know, you can call it, oh, we tolerate, you know, diversity. We tolerate all these other ways of thinking about the world. This is like we say, like, oh, like we tolerate religious freedom, but like, you know, keep it to yourself. It's like, well, no, but if you truly believe in that religion, like the fact that you are not able to impose your vision of a just world onto the world as it is that not tyranny in itself? I mean, obviously that leads down a million different rabbit holes, but the idea is, especially as it refers to like this multiculturalism in a liberal society, as you were getting at, like, you know, you can't dream of a better world if you are not immediately already in the center of the action. Like that is, the barriers are just insurmountable.
Yeah. We go so far as to call someone who doesn't function in a specific way disabled.
Mm.
Like, what does that even... Where does that even come from? Like, oh, and I was thinking too, because I was lying down on the carpet, on the ground. I live on the second story, and I was lying down on the ground for some reason. I think I was just reading a book. But anyways, I was lying on the ground, and I was like, this ground is so uncomfortable because it's only here to serve one express function. And that's just to hold things up. As opposed to if you're lying on the ground outside and you can just nestle up, I mean, in some moss and some trees and the grass, and you are just enjoying yourself and you're comforted and you're cushioned because of everything that's going on. And you're in this landscape that's multifunctional, serving so many purposes. But if you lie on the ground inside the house, you're just like, ouch, you know, it hurts because it only serves one function.
Mm.
It's just standards, it's a standardized thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the staleness of that utilitarian center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the clinicalness, right?
Yes.
You can't cuddle on this ground. You can sleep there. If you're a person, if you don't serve X function, you're out.
Mm.
You're no good. Come on. What's up with that? That's ridiculous. That is so ridiculous, especially when you think about all the amazing diversity of people, of creativity, innovation, everything. And to just shut out people is ridiculous.
How do you feel like this kind of reclamation of agriculture fits into this, maybe a rebuttal of the standardization of everything?
I am so glad that you asked me that, Brendan. Because you never know what sort of creative, innovative solution somebody's going to come to in the garden. And there's all these amazing different factors. It doesn't matter what sounds good on paper. What matters is what works. Mm-hmm. And you may be somebody who's constantly looking at like the stems of plants, and you're looking at plants from underneath and wondering what it's like to be a bug inside those plants. And your unique perspective could serve some amazing, amazing goal, right? You may be able to do something with the plants that nobody else thought of or could have ever done. You might be somebody who thinks very mathematically, and you're very concerned with like geometry and angles, and you pay close attention to that. And yeah, you could discover something really fantastic to do with like rainwater harvesting or solar panels. And like everybody's unique approach works because you're applying it to a natural system, which is organic, in flux, in motion. It needs diversity. It needs innovation. It needs creativity. It's not standardized. You know, there's no standard way in which a tree grows. You know, there's always something. They're always going to do their thing. So I think there's so much space for true diversity of thought and of capability or whatever in nature. 100%. And I don't want to speak too much on things that I don't know about, but autism is something that comes to mind a lot, and I think about often. I wonder to what extent the stimulation of our day-to-day world, where we just have so much going on, all these smells from nasty cars, all these bright flashing lights, you know, you have a candy and you just get hit with like 23 grams of sugar. And like, I can't help but wonder how people who have autism would do in a different society. And I can't help but wonder as well if certain abilities that they have, like to hyperfocus and things like that, would actually be excellent. Like maybe you would have been the best freaking hunter in the village. You know? And in this society, like we think of it as non-functional because we want kind of generalized folks.
Yeah. I know. I find it, autism is, right, the way we deal with autism is fascinating. I think it's interesting how, especially lately, there's kind of been like a change of tone, I think, in the way we speak about autism, where what was initially non-functional has been recognized as like hyper-functional. Obviously autism was one of those things where it's like, there's so much diversity within what we call autism that like making any generalization is kind of ridiculous. But, you know, you think about your classic like autistic kid who's just like in this deep focus or just like this like obsession with something. In a workforce that is like hyper specialized, there's this kind and increasingly automated, there's this sense I get where it's like employers, kind of capital, is waking up to like this weird exploitative relationship to autism, where it's like you can take what was supposedly non-functional and reclaim it as just like this overzealous drive or focus towards the production of a certain thing, which like I can't tell which is worse. And it's just so tragic that these kind of, these like brilliant people who deviate only slightly, because they deviate slightly, they are subjected to this constant pull and tug between like where, like how do we make this fit? Like where does this fit? And again, it's like this strange sense of we tolerate autism and we even like, you know, venerate it to a degree where it's like, you are like such a good worker. You're so focused. Like you're so brilliant. You're so knowledgeable about this one specific subject. And at the same time, as we say these things, one, we either cast it to the periphery or we take it in and turn it into like a robotic, just like, I don't know. It's a very interesting dynamic. And I fear for the future of our discourse around these kind of deviations, if that makes sense.
It does. And I mean, the sense I'm getting from this is it's something that people are realizing, this like trait, this quality that many autistic people have, can be exploited commercially, productivity.
Yeah.
I want to talk about productivity.
Okay, go off.
I would like us to speak about productivity together. And like, what do you think of productivity? Do you think there's a cult of productivity?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, I have a very complicated relationship with productivity because I rail on it all the time. And yet I'm such a simp to its demands. Oh, it's just terrible. Well, the thing is, like, even like this is one thing I always talk about with my friends, where it's like, you know, I constantly like, oh my god, I'm so busy, and they're like, Brennan, you bird all the time, and I'm like, that's part of it, like, because like I truly like even my like passions are motivated by this like just this urgent sense of like I need to like be out there, I need to be doing it, and like the fine line between like that kind of drive, that kind of like lust and appetite for the world, and a sense to like where productivity begins and where productivity kind of ends within that scope is very complicated. I don't feel like I've come to a particularly cohesive conclusion about kind of where I fall and how I feel about it. I do think productivity can be reduced beyond this kind of discussion, just in terms of like the way it's often talked about, and again, a very like clinical way, you know, talking about the productivity of the worker or the productivity of the student. And of course, how the productivity of the student relates to the productivity of the worker. There's a ton of different connections to be drawn here. But whether or not my relationship to productivity is so dependent on that kind of naturalization, that even what I love and enjoy that's supposed to be my downtime is consumed by that same productive urge, or whether or not that productive urge is just implicit in who I am as a person to be a part of this like living and vibrant world. I don't know. It's kind of unnerving. It gets under my skin. How about you?
I wonder if it's a matter of humanity to want to be productive, to want to produce, like produce a podcast or create, you know, and just be these like creative building, constructing creatures, no matter what we are building or constructing. And perhaps it could have something to do with the fact that we're not spending like 10, 15 hours a day trying to secure food, right? Like we have all this time to do other things. But I don't know. I think for myself, I definitely feel like I want to be creating, producing. I don't feel great if I'm sitting there. You know, I have to really go out of my way to be like, okay, I'm just going to sit here. And like, even like to read, you know, I've gotten much better about reading. I can be a little hard on myself just for watching TV or something. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much of that, you know, like you, I'm thinking, is this just a part of who I innately am?
Yeah. we can talk about the construction of the self and all the intricacies of that for hours. But no, I totally
Or is it the social thing where like there's a part of me that's just like, I need to be productive or I do not function. Right?
Yeah.
Like my identity is tied to what I create. Otherwise, I'm a passive consumer with no place in puritanical society. I don't know. I feel like it's a little bit of both, to be honest with you. Like part of me genuinely enjoys it, but I'd be lying if I say there wasn't some guilt associated.
Not to project this onto you, but I feel like that kind of confluence, that when you recognize the kind of like contradiction at place there, or you're trying to kind of unravel it, agriculture or like gardening seems like a useful outlet for that, because it's like, as you said, like, you know, so much of this desire to be productive in our free time comes from this like kind of liberation from the necessities of, you know, growing our own food or whatever. But kind of reverting back to that, it reclaims the discussion of productivity, like what is actually productive. I don't know, is that something you feel when you're
Well, that's kind of funny.
Your plants, like, is that productive time? I don't know. Like,
It's interesting because one of the things I do a lot is I play guitar, and I see guitar as productive in some ways, because on one hand, I'm literally producing notes. I'm producing,
right.
You know, I'm literally producing notes. I'm like producing a song, but I'm not like publishing it. Like there is a song out there that I have created. Right. But then like I get this feeling, this gnawing feeling. It's terrifying, Brendan. I'll get it about my art too, because I paint. I'll get this feeling. What if I'm wasting my time? Do you ever feel that way about
all the time?
It's so terrible, because I'm like, no, this is good for me. Like, I enjoy it. I like to be creative, you know. But then there's a part of me that's like, maybe you should be designing a better government or something. Like, I don't even know. Just like immediately applicable to the issues of our day.
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah, there's that is very interesting. I feel that 110% in so many different ways. It's like this. I mean, I often revert to the example of birding because I bird all the time. And I often think about like, I mean, obviously like I love birding to death, and I will defend, I can talk about the, you know, the benefits and subversive radical nature of birding for hours. But there is always, I will sometimes, especially in like right now, summer is not a great time to bird. And so I'll be like kind of wandering through the woods in my like hour of free time, and there's not a single bird singing. It's kind of just like this hot oppressive blanket laid over the landscape, and I don't feel like I'm particularly getting all that much. And but I still, if I'm not outside birding, I'm like, I should be birding, because I just, it's like it's just a nagging force in the back of my mind being like, oh, because I every time I'm not outside, I'm missing something. Like I love birds, I love birding. But then you go outside and you're wandering around slowly, and like the pace of life is, everything's slowed down. And then you start to get this, I get this nagging feeling in my brain where it's like, well, I have so many things I've been meaning to work on. Like, is this the most productive way to spend my time? And then you get back inside, you sit down in your chair and you open up your computer to write. And all of a sudden, you know, you just lapse into listening to robins sing in the neighborhood trees. And you're like, oh man, I wish I was outside right now. And it's just like this back and forth. And again, understanding, untangling whether or not that's something that's innate to me, whether it's just like, I'm always going to be dealing with that pull and tug, or whether or not it's something that's been ingrained in me, and I'm suffering from some unhealthy standard or from some unhealthy expectations of productivity. And that's scary, because like, yeah, untangling yourself from what people have made you, or like what the world has made you, is quite challenging, and is obviously at the crux of like so much that we do and so much that we discuss. Also interesting that I brought pull and tug again. I said that a little while ago in relationship to autism. I know many people who would consider themselves like somewhat autistic, again, whatever that may mean, some clinically diagnosed, others just with a hunch. And I also am on the side where like I have a hunch that like maybe some mild autism mixed into the mix here. And that's one of the reasons why, because there's just this like the feeling of being pulled and tugged, and that being not something that's necessarily innate to me, but rather the way the world like is the external factors that are pulling at me. I don't know. That's obviously a contested topic, but take it as you will.
I'm just thinking about how we could describe this episode and being like, Kamala Harris and autism.
What does autism
have to do with these?
Yeah, man. Yeah, watch as we draw an incredible connection between autism and Kamala Harris's ascendancy to the vice presidential docket.
Kamala. I keep on wanting to say Kamala. Kamala. Com, like .com, Kamala.
I'm just waiting for someone to be like, goddamn commie, as like a nickname for her. But it's also like, you know, I feel like that's like a low-hanging fruit. I'm really surprised no one in the right has picked up on that. Yeah. If I was a Republican campaign strategist, damn, it would be over.
I know. But what's just so like about that is no commie would claim her.
No, absolutely not.
No commie would claim her whatsoever.
Yeah, no, she would be like in this terrible, if they did that, she would be in this terrible position where I'd be like, the right would be like, goddamn commie, like, you know, take her out back, put a bullet in her head, and then like the left would be like, oh my god, ew, no, like, as a real commie, like, get that woman away from me. And then I feel so bad for her.
I feel uncomfortable with what is going to come, because, like, I mean, she's not my choice, but, you know, she's a person. She's still a person, and I just know that some of the stuff that's going to be said about her, that has been said about her, is just going to get dirty, yeah. Dirty about her race, about the fact that she's a woman, you know. It's not going to be cute.
Do you think we should have much empathy for politicians? Or do they kind of like ask for it?
I think it's more powerful to address someone's policy and their actions. But then again, at the same time, somebody may do actions that are like, dang, this person's evil, because only an evil person would do these actions. And I think that that's pretty reasonable. But I think what starts to get pretty nasty is when we start to, for example, with Kamala.
Hey! I saw yourself catching yourself in the moment. That was good.
What's up? So like with Kamala, for example, maybe you're just starting to be like, well, you know, this stupid black woman, you know, like, oh my gosh, like,
yeah.
Please don't. I feel like that's really unnecessary. But I mean, if someone's like, oh yeah, like, screw Kamala, she does this. I mean, all right.
Yeah.
You know, so be it. I'm not going to police it, because it's not like these decisions are so removed, right, from like our day-to-day life.
Yeah.
It's not what, like, actually affect us.
What do you think, I mean, from Kamala's position, what do you think is more hurtful to her? Someone on the right being like, I don't know, just some racially charged comment, some sexist comment, or someone from the left or even the center being like, Kamala is a cop and like has a long record of like locking up black people disproportionately for like, you know, whether it be drug possession, etc., or like make some really cutting and like maybe slightly problematic remark along those lines, where it's like, she's like race traitor, whatever, versus someone who's like, no, like, you are trash because of blah blah blah, sex, blah blah blah, race, whatever.
Yeah.
The right and left, like, which insult do you feel like gets to her more?
The great Lizzo said it best. Truth hurts.
Yeah.
Truth hurts, you know? I mean, you can always, if someone says something about the
but which one? But which one's the truth? I mean, it's true that, like, as a black woman in American politics, like, you are going to just, like, catch, there's going to be a hatred directed at you from a large proportion of the American populace. Like, that's true. But it's also true that, you know, her record is bad. So, like, which one? I don't know. How do you?
Yeah. I mean, well, if someone were to pass a judgment on her for being black or for being a woman, I mean, that definitely hurts, because that's, like, what's wrong with you? But, I mean, if someone calls you out for your actual behavior, right, that's a little different, because that's, like, oh, this is stuff I did. And it's also interesting to me, we think of Kamala as a, who is black? What is black, right? Mm. She would be the first black vice president, just as Obama was the first black president. Obama's half white. And I'm not sitting here, it's not really my duty to say who is what, right? Because that's very much a personal decision, I believe, based on the kinds of experiences that you've had in your life. And we know race to be a pretty nebulous thing. But it is interesting. It is interesting what certain mixes, like, nobody's going to be like, oh, this person's this or that, right? But I don't know. It goes back to the one drop thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just think it's interesting.
It'll be interesting to see the attacks leveled from her on both sides. I mean, I think this is, you know, this is, again, maybe looping back to some stuff you were talking about at the beginning, and we probably should wrap it up here. We are running quite the clock, but regardless, there's, you know, the sense, one of the, like, an old mantra is like, oh, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And I feel like I still hear that being said, and I'm just like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, this, like, how can you say that with a straight face in today's political moment? Like, that's just ridiculous. And there's all the sense where it's like, oh, like, you know, the left, like, the left, right? I say that with just, like, such, like, a roll of my eyes. But people will be like, oh, my God, you know, Democrats, like, they eat themselves alive. Like, they're so mean to each other in the primaries. Like, you know, you constantly heard that level that, like, your conventional Bernie bro. It's like, be nice. And it's like, I thought, and the rationale for that is like, oh, because Democrats don't know how to fall in line. Like, because we fall in love all the time. And it's like, literally, like, look how that turned out. Like, we are now the ones falling in line. And it's the Republicans who are in love. And like, who's going to win out here? Like, which is the more resilient vision? Like, I don't know. It's just
love. That's so funny, because when you first said that, I thought, when you were talking love, I was thinking, like, you know, it's 2008, it's 2009, gay marriage is illegal in the US, and now we're going to legalize it and also bring in this, like, pink capitalism and, like, the rainbow pride. So I was kind of thinking on, like, terms of that. But
it's certainly relative. But, like, yeah. the way we, like, relate to our leaders. Like,
got you know,
the way we stand for our politicians, like Yas Queen, Yas Khan,
shut up,
Yas Obama. Yeah, I know. It's like,
I mean, I did fall in love with a politician.
Who?
Two, three.
Who? Tell me.
Two. Bernie, AOC, Elon.
You feel like you're in the, No, I know. She is cool. And I mean, that is like one of the projections that I feel like I'm most uncertain about. People are like, all right, 2024 or 2028 or 2028. People are like, all right, the ticket is going to be AOC v Tucker Carlson. And I'm like, oh my God, if that's where we get, if we're still locked in that, if that's still the divide in 2028, like, we are so fucked. Like, I feel so bad for AOC, because she's just like, she really has her head in the right place, right? Like, I really feel like she stands in solidarity where she needs to stand, but she just like is embroiled in this like electoral, like this just arena of electoral politics that is like so corrosive to any like revolutionary message. Like, you know, it's, and that's why I feel like, I do feel like, you know, just as I loved Bernie and I like love people like AOC for what they stand for the kind of campaigns they run, like, I can't stay in love with a politician. Like, it's impossible, right? Because it's like, that just doesn't allow for that. And maybe that's not me being like, you know, not a pragmatist, but like, that's still a real discussion that we need to have.
The future of progressive politics.
Yeah.
Where are we going to go?
Well, that's a topic for a whole nother. I think we've touched on some crucial topics within that sphere so far today. So,
you know, we have, and I totally was here. I was ready to talk about Confucianism.
I know, we had all these notes. We just like, yeah.
I thought we were going to be talking about the etymology of the word lawyer today. I was like, oh, I have some notes on Gaelic. But we'll get to those whenever we get there. This was really interesting.
Yeah, listeners, for context, we thought we were going to record a, I don't even know what day that was. Monday? Sunday? We thought we were going to record an episode on Sunday. Basically, it was going to be this. It was just going to be the two of us. And we got on the phone to talk about it. And then we had just had a full phone conversation for like 3.5 hours. And didn't record a single thing. And then we're like, damn, we should have recorded that. Like, that was pretty good. And so now we're basically just doing the same thing, but it's entirely different. The idea was that we're going to take some of the points we talked about there and kind of reinterpret them, go over them again on air. But oh well, that didn't happen.
C'est la vie. We had a very emergent conversation though, and I think some really good stuff came up. And I personally feel really inspired to look up more into Kamala Harris, her past, learn more about the 70s, and all kinds of different things. So thank you, Brendan, for
likewise,
exposed me to some good stuff.
As always, you have inspired me to go outside and lay on the ground and look up at the underside of leaves and imagine new ways of engaging with the world.
Thank you.
A gift that you impart on everyone who you talk to. So
I love that. I appreciate you saying that, man. All right.
Yeah, we'll be back soon with some interviews with other guests. I know today it was just the two of us. We need that every once in a while. But yeah, we'll be bringing the heat soon. Stay tuned. signing off.
Bye.